I was like the youngest guy in the lodge by 20 years. And this guy comes forward and he says, we're going to lead you through this oath. But it's this long, involved, and ultimately blood-curdling oath. What none of these men understand is that deep down inside, there's this very dark, evil energy. I would go up to these guys that have been in the Scottish Rite forever. And I'd say, okay, I'm now a sublime prince of the royal secret. So what's the royal secret? And again, this is something that probably only one in a thousand Masons in America understands. Is that the royal secret?
Hello and welcome back to the Almost False podcast, where I interview regular people with incredible stories. Today's guest is someone who has explored the darkest levels of spirituality, one of them being Freemasonry. He became a 33rd degree Mason, was part of high-level secret societies, and he is not afraid to share what he's not supposed to talk about. So I took this opportunity to ask him as much as I could in the limited time that we had. No matter how much you know or don't know about Freemasonry, I can almost guarantee you that you'll learn a lot from this interview, as everything that is shared here is in some way related to it. Get ready to have your mind blown by Mr. Bill Snevlin as he shares the dark journey that him and his wife took and the unsettling things that they uncovered along the way.
When I got to college, and again, I wanted to be a priest. This was a minor seminary college, Loras College. At the time, it was a minor seminary. It isn't anymore. I had a priest in my theology class who had a doctorate in theology, and he was teaching a course in Christology. Because again, I was wanting to be a priest. And he took me aside and he said, if you want to be a priest in the Catholic Church, it's taught, you know, sacerdotus est altus Christus, the priest is another Christ. So if you want to be like Christ, he says to me, do you want to be like Christ? And I says, well, of course. Doesn't every Christian want to be like Christ? And he said, well, if you want to be like Christ, you need to do what Christ did. And again, that made sense. And again, nowadays we've kind of become suspicious about priests. But this was like 1968. And a priest was like God. I mean, whatever the priest said, that was it, you know. And he said, well, if you want to be like Christ, you need to do what he did. And he went to the East and studied with the gurus in India. He went and studied with the lamas in Tibet. He went to Egypt and studied with the magicians there. That's how he was able to do, to raise the dead, to walk on water, to do all these miracles. So he says, what you need to do is you need to start studying the occult. And this is a priest telling me this. And so I thought, okay, now mind you, this is obviously decades before there was an internet. I mean, there was a little bookstore downtown. And I went there and I found a few scattering books on like the occult, and I found this book that was called Diary of a Witch by Sybil Leek. And she was one of the very first witches to, so to speak, come out of the broom closet. She was a British woman, and she was a medium. And anyhow, I read the book, and she was asserting in the book that witches were not evil, that this was an ancient pagan mystery religion. Among other things, she claimed that Jesus was a witch and his 12 apostles were his coven, along with their wives, you know. So I kind of bought into that. And I found out about this guy, Alex Sanders, who was the supposed king of the witches over in London. I sent him a letter. This is around 1968, 69. And his wife sent me back a thing. Okay, here's a coven in Rockford, Illinois, which is about 90 minutes from Dubuque. I went there and I got initiated as a witch. And then later on, I hooked up with an Alexandrian coven in Boston, and I was made a witch high priest. Started covens in, first of all, in Dubuque, where I was, and then moved to Milwaukee because there was a fellow there who had an occult bookstore. Because Milwaukee's a huge city. And he said, I've got all these people that want to become witches. Can you come and teach them?
When we're talking about like you being in a coven and you doing witchcraft, I just want to make sure that we don't skip over that part. Like, what kind of witchcraft are we talking about? Because, there's a lot of...
It was witchcraft originally, the kind of publicly available witchcraft was originally started by Gerald Gardner, And he came out, and witchcraft became legal in England. It was a crime until 1951. It was made legal. And he claimed, and all of this is disputed, but he claimed that he came in contact with an ancient coven of witches in the New Forest region of England. They initiated him and then made him a high priest, and he went off and initiated other people. Then there's this other bunch, this Alexander's fellow. He also claims to have been initiated by an ancient line of witches by his grandmother. So those were the two main fountainheads of witchcraft in the 60s. Both were from England, but both had, you know, spread to America. And it was white witchcraft. Both groups, their rituals were virtually identical. And but the Alexandrian group that I was in was more into ceremonial magic, which is like kind of, if you know, in like Protestantism, they have the distinction between high church and low church. Well, Alexandrian is more high church witchcraft, but we didn't believe in the devil. We didn't think we were worshiping the devil. We thought we were worshiping a goddess, a moon goddess, and a horn god. So it was like dietheism, if you will, two deities. And we didn't believe in demons. We just believed that it was all this nature, airy, fairy, you know, gathering herbs in the forest and dancing in the nude. And, you know, it all sounds very innocent. Except there's, especially in the Alexandrian rite, there's also some sex magic that's involved. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yes, yes. Thank you for clarifying. I just wanted to make sure that we got that covered. So actually, let's go back to the occult bookstore that you were talking about, and let's pick up the story from there.
Well, so anyway, I mean, so we hooked up with this fellow in the basement of the store. We would hold these classes. They were packed because there were all these people. And again, this was 1972. And, you know, there was all these people who are kind of like quasi-hippies, and they wanted to get into the occult and magic and blah, blah, blah. The other thing that happened at the same time is that we encountered this fellow called Eli, who was a grandmaster druid of North America. And druids are a little bit different than witches. It's kind of like the difference between being a Baptist and being a Methodist, you know. And we were invited down to Arkansas, which is where this fellow lived. He had lived on top of a mountain. He had kind of a organic farm there. And we went through the whole summer, got all this occult training. We were, you know, high priests in druidism by the time we got done. At one point, I understand this fellow that owned the occult bookstore, he was kind of a manipulative guy who was very, you know, he was older than me, very cunning. He told me, he took me aside and he said, you know, if you really want to understand magic, you need to read this book. And he handed me the Satanic Bible by Anton LaVey. And I said, well, why would I want to read the Satanic Bible? Witches don't believe in Satan. And he said, well, just read the book. And his, LaVey's, contention was that magic is really about Satan. But Satan is like an archetype, he said. There is no real Satan, but it's like an energy, an egregore, an archetype that you can draw upon. And it kind of made sense to me. And again, the devil was gradually pulling me in. Like the whole thing about the camel getting its nose into the tent, and before you know it, the camel's in there. So I wrote The Church of Satan, which at that time was in San Francisco. I became a member, a first-degree member. And then later on, I went through some exams and studies, and I became a warlock, which was a second degree member of the Church of Satan. And at this also, I should say this, because this is critical. This Eli guy, the Grand Druid down in Arkansas, he gave us two words of advice. First of all, he said, if you really want to understand Luciferian energy, you need to join the Freemasonic Order. And he himself was a 33rd degree Mason. He showed me his little certificate he got. He also told me that if he ever felt like we were in deep spiritual trouble, that I should join the Mormon Church. because it was a church that had started by witches for witches that we could hang out in and pretend to be nice. You know the image of the Mormon church. They're straight, nice, wonderful, all-American people with happy families and white picket fences and, you know, all of that. But secretly, they believe almost the same doctrines that witches believe. And we can get into that if you want. But anyhow, so he gave us that advice. And again, this was in the early 70s. So I joined the Masonic Lodge, became a Master Mason, at the same time as I was a Satanist and a witch. And only our inner circle of the witches that we've initiated over 100 witches. And only our inner circle knew that we were also Satanists. And we were continuing in this, and I finally figured out that there was a deeper level of Satanism. And I got in touch with some of them. Again, there was no internet. We had to do all this by mail and whatnot. And there was a group in Michigan called the Order of the Black Ram, which is like more hardcore satanic stuff. There was another group in Chicago called The Brotherhood. And I got involved with them because they were closer, because Milwaukee's just up the road about 90 miles from Chicago. And I got really, I sold my soul to the devil. That's how deep I got into this stuff.
Yeah. Before we actually get to that part, I want to make sure to take some time to talk about Freemasonry, because Freemasonry, it's very rare to actually talk about to talk to former Masons, because it's something that you're not supposed to talk about. So it's kind of an opportunity while I have you here to kind of, for me personally, to learn, but also for the people to kind of have a knowledge about what Freemasonry is. You said that you became a Master Mason. Can you explain how the degrees and the lodges are set up in Freemasonry so people actually understand what we're talking about?
Well, the basic thing is what's called the Blue Lodge, and that consists of 3 degrees: Entered Apprentice, Fellow Craft, and Master Mason. A lot of Masons never go any further than that. I did, but basically, it's like an initiatory process. The requirements are you have to, at that time, now mind you, this was, I think I joined in 75. You had to be a man, freeborn, of good report, and well-recommended. So they ask you if you believe in God, and I said, yes, I did. And they didn't ask which God I believed in. They just, do you believe in God? And I said, yes. And I didn't tell them that the God I believed in had horns. So anyhow, I went through there's this whole process. You do a lot of memory work, they call it. You memorize all of these ritual things. You have a mentor who's called your poster, who's an older Mason. And the guy that I had was a real, very kind guy, an executive in the power company. I can't remember the name of the company. And he helped me memorize all this stuff. And then you go to second degree, and then you have a whole bunch of stuff to memorize. And just let me touch this briefly, because people ask me, well, at what point does Masonry start to look creepy? I mean, because there's tons of Christians that are Masons, literally thousands of them. And I just ask them, how can you do that? I mean, because when you start out as a Mason, they make you, you come to the lodge, they make you take off all your clothes except your undies. They put you in this like jammies. They're like, they're like pajamas. They're like, typically the one knee is bare and one breast is bare. Your left breast. And I think your right knee. And you're blindfolded. And you have a cable around your neck. It's like a velvet, they call it a cable toe. It's like a velvet blue rope. And you're tied up. And you're led to the door of the lodge. And you've got a guy leading you, because, of course, you're blindfolded. And he knocks on the door, and somebody on, this is all ritualized. And the guy on the other side says, who comes here? And your guy who's guiding you, who's a lodge officer, he says, Mr. Bill Snevlin, who has been long in darkness, and now seeks to be brought to light, to receive the rights and benefits of the worshipful lodge, erected to God as all members have done before. And I ask, Mr. Christian, Mr. Pastor, Mr. Elder, because there's, like it used to be, I don't know if it still is, it used to be 40% of the pastors in a Southern Baptist convention were Freemasons. And how can you say that you're in darkness when you have Jesus in your heart? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, that's not it. You go into the lodge, you're led around, like they call it circumambulation. You walk around the lodge. They have these officers, a junior warden, the senior warden at the different, you know, things of the compass. And in the east is the worshipful master, who's like the big cheese. Then you're made to kneel at this altar. Again, you're still blindfolded. And you're made to understand that you're putting your hands on this huge, it's like a pulpit Bible, you know, big King James Bible. And this guy comes forward, this worshipful master, and he says, you know, we're going to lead you through this oath. And I'm not going to go through the whole oath because it takes like 5 minutes, but it's this long, involved, and ultimately blood-curdling oath. At the end, you say, you swear the essence of the oath is to keep the secrets of an apprentice Mason, which, of course, I'm violating right now. And then at the end, you swear that if I should ever reveal the secrets of an apprentice Mason, that I swear that I will have my throat cut across, my tongue torn out by the roots and buried in the sands of the sea where the tide ebbs and flows twice in 24 hours, should I ever knowingly violate this, my apprentice obligation. So help me God and keep me steadfast to the due performance of the same. Now, if you were a Christian pastor or whatever, wouldn't that kind of raise the hair on the back of your neck?
Yeah, I think it would raise the head on the back of the necks of pretty much most people just to hear that.
Yeah. And then at that point, the worshipful master says, my brother, in your current situation, what do you most desire? And then the guy that's with you, that he's a senior warden, says light, whispers it in your ear. And I say light. And then they remove the blindfold. And you see before you this big open Bible with a square and compass on it. And it is, those are represent the three great lights of Masonry: the Bible, the square, and the compass. And then they are revealed by the three lesser lights of Masonry, which are three burning tapers that are adjacent to the altar. Now, that's the most mild initiation. From there on, they get more and more creepy. So I don't know how deep you want to go into this, but basically, Masonry is an antichrist thing. It claims it's not religious, but it is. You know, they play around with it because they say, oh, well, we're just religious, but we're not a religion. Because if they were a religion, then if you were already a Christian, you shouldn't join another religion. Most Christians would say that. Like, if you're a Christian, you wouldn't become a Buddhist.
Right.
Well, Masonry is a religion. I mean, it has all the qualities. This is what I tell people. If you look at Webster's dictionary, there's three things that make something a religion, according to Webster. Number one, something that has a belief in some sort of deity. Masonry has that. Number two, that belief is expressed in some sort of ritual. And Masonry is full of ritual. I mean, that's pretty much all it is. And then the third quality is it has a system of some sort of ethics or morality. And Masonry has that. So Masonry is a religion. And it's an antichrist religion. And the problem is that basically, if you drill down into this deep enough and read the books that are written by people like Albert Pike, like Albert Mackey, these are two, you know, or Arthur Edward Waite. These are three prominent scholars of 19th century, early 20th century Masonry. And all of them were occultists. Arthur Edward Waite, he wrote a book on black magic and pacts, how to sell your soul to the devil. And in my book, shameless plug. This is an older edition. This is the first edition. It looks different now. But in my book, I document how almost every single leading occult person of the late 19th and early 20th century was a Freemason. They just go together, like, you know, love and marriage.
If people want to go look at these books, I just want you to like kind of give them an idea, because if they want to confirm that for themselves, what books are you talking about? What people are you talking about?
Well, there's Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike. He was like the greatest Masonic scholar in America, the 19th century. He was a sovereign grand commander of the Scottish Rite, and he's buried in the Scottish Rite Temple, 13 blocks from the White House. So that's one. The other one is Albert Mackey's Encyclopedia of Freemasonry. There's Arthur Edward Waite, who has a whole bunch of books on Masonry. Again, all of these are footnoted in my book. I mean, the last lots of pages of footnotes, because I'm not just making this stuff up. The other person who really you need to pay attention to in all of this, because he's more contemporary. Have you ever heard of Manly P. Hall?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the most notable occultists in America in the 20th century. He passed away in 1994, I think. He was the head of the Philosophical Research Society. He was a very high-level ceremonial magician. And he was also a 33rd-degree Mason. And he wrote this book, Lost Keys of Freemasonry. And in that book, among many things, he says that when you become a master Mason, you are like a warrior on the block. And that's kind of Masonic code. And the seething energies of Lucifer are yours to command.
So these are like the biggest Freemasonic figures that we know about today. And yet most Freemasons have no idea about this.
Yeah, because they don't read the books. They join the lodge for whatever reason. It might be for business. Because, see, it used to be that up until, I think, the early 90s, lawyers and doctors were not allowed to advertise. They couldn't put, like, an ad in the telephone book. It was like an ethics thing. And so the only way that lawyers and doctors could kind of build up business was by Masonry. They join the Masonic Lodge. They send referrals to one another, you know, a good old boys network. So that's why a lot of people join the lodge. Many people join it because they had an uncle or a father or a brother who was in it. And honestly, unless you really understand the occult, it's boring. I mean, imagine the most boring church service you've ever been in. And having spent 5 years in the Mormon church, I can relate to that. But it's just, you know, guys were sitting there snoring during the Masonic ritual when I was there. And, you know, because it's like watching paint dry. And they go every week. And when I was involved in this, I was like the youngest guy in the lodge by 20 years. All these guys were like 50, 60, 70 years old, you know, and basically they were there because they were buddies. And afterwards, they'd, you know, play poker and eat, you know, sandwiches or something. But what none of these men understand, I don't think, is that deep down inside, there's this very dark, evil energy, which is very sexualized. We document in the book how many men that have come to us over the years for deliverance, they were in Masonry and they began to be drawn into wickedness, into perversion, and even in the pedophilia. And it's dark, dangerous stuff because it opens up unholy desires within the men. And then, because of the way the spiritual world works, that in turn percolates down into their family. And it affects the wife, who may or may not be involved, because there's a women's order of Masonry called the Order of the Eastern Star, whose symbol is a satanic pentagram, by the way. So anyway, it affects your children. So many men that were Masons, at first it didn't create a problem, but when their children started hitting puberty, they just started to go in various ways nuts because of this trickle-down influence of the Masonic Lodge.
Yeah, I actually interviewed a woman whose dad was a Freemason, and something very similar to that happened to her. So she was never involved in, you know, the Eastern Stars. And as far as I understand, her mom wasn't involved either. But there was, you know, an element of the children thing that you talked about with their family being abused, her siblings, sorry. And she also, around puberty, started developing, you know, some weird things. So it does correlate with what you're talking about. But I want to make sure that people understand. I want to go back to the degrees of Freemasonry. You talked about the Blue Lodge. You also mentioned the Scottish Rite. There's the York Rite. Can you explain how that's set up so people actually understand what it means to be a 33rd degree Mason? Because I think it's just there's a lot of confusion around it.
Well, it's a little complicated, but in America, English Masonry is different. But in America, after Blue Lodge, it forks off in two directions. You can either go to the Scottish Rite or the York Rite. The York Rite has 7 degrees. The Scottish Rite has 29 degrees. When I was made a Master Mason, I was told, because at that time, believe it or not, I was going to the seminary to become an old Catholic priest. And some of my brother Masons knew that. And they said, well, the York Rite is the Christian path, so to speak. So why don't you go up that thing first? So I did. And the top of the York Rite is what is called the Knights Templar degree. Now, in the Scottish Rite, you have these 29 degrees. Some of them are really creepy. I mean, seriously creepy. They have one, I think it's a 19th degree, where they actually try to call up the devil. And finally, at the top, the 32nd degree, which is the Sublime Prince of the Royal Secret. And that's as high as most people go. If you're some really important person, either in industry or in politics or in entertainment, you might be offered to become a 33rd degree Mason, which is the highest degree in American Masonry. And many people, you know, presidents, actors, I mean, people like, you know, Roy Rogers, Harry Truman, all kinds of celebrities, Burl Ives, they're 33rd or were, they're all deceased now, 33rd degree Masons, Gene Autry, many of these people. So that's the structure of it. And there's nuances in the York Rite that are very creepy, but the Scottish Rite is much more creepy.
Hey, I'm pausing here just to let you know that if you want more details about this testimony, whether you want more context about what happened before, or you have questions that I didn't ask, then consider joining us on Locals. We put out a bunch of extra content there, like the extra footage, which is everything that happened before the story started, or the after show, which is what happened after, along with advice that our guests have for you. There's also a whole other episodes that are not available anywhere else, so why don't you go check it out? It's free to join. You don't have anything to lose and have a whole lot to gain. It also helps us to remain independent and fight censorship, so if you're interested, the link will be in the description. You can head over there after the episode is done. All right, now let's get back in the story. Okay, so to make sure that everyone understands, you know, kind of what you already set up, I'll try to summarize it. So there's the Blue Lodge, which everyone has to go through, which is 3 degrees, and then you have two choices, either the York Rite, which is 7, or the Scottish Rite, which is 29. So 3 plus 29 equals 32. So 32 degrees and honorary 33rd degree for people that are deemed to be important. So that's kind of how it worked. Only on the Scottish Rite, that's where the 33rd degree happens. So,
well, let me just correct something.
Yes, please.
If you're a 10th degree Ninth Templar, you can become a 33rd degree Mason even if you never went through the Scottish Rite.
Okay.
Minor detail, but
okay. Thank you for clarifying. So, all right. Now we talked about the 33rd degree Mason. People usually are like, that's the highest level of Freemasonry that there is. There's also a bunch of people that talk about, you know, there's secrets in Freemasonry that a lot of people don't know about, and you have to, you know, be deemed worthy to be told these secrets. You became a 33rd degree Mason, and you eventually joined this secret group or secret order or whatever you want to call it. Can you explain what that is?
Okay. Well, beyond what we've just been talking about, over in Europe, there's what's called the Rite of Memphis Mitzrayim, and that is 360 degrees beyond what's, you know, I've already discussed. And most Masons don't even know about that. Now, I got up to the, if memory serves, 96th degree. And because how I did that is there was a group in Chicago where they were involved with that thing, because Chicago was and probably still is a major nexus of Satanism. Most people don't know that. So this group brought me into Memphis Mizraim, and ultimately there was a fellow that flew over all the way from Paris, who was the son of Pappus. Now, you probably don't know that name, but Pappus was a very prominent 19th century high-level occultist and ceremonial magician, and he wrote a book called The Tarot of the Bohemians, or about tarot cards, you know. And he came over and he brought me into the 97th degree. And this is where you get into the really deep stuff, the ideas behind sexual alchemy, how to supposedly live forever, you know, all this creepy stuff. Anyway, I would go up to these guys that had been in the Scottish Rite forever, you know, older men that were in their 60s. And I'd say, okay, I'm now a sublime prince of the royal secret. You know, whang, they did this initiation and I was a sublime prince of the royal secret. And so what's the royal secret? And they go, I don't know. Now, whether they were just feigning ignorance, because at this time I was like in my late 20s, or what, I don't know. But I learned eventually, after getting into the Rite of Memphis Mitzrayim, and again, this is something that probably only 1 in 1,000 Masons in America understands, is that the royal secret is that you can live forever by sexually vampirizing children. Literally. And that's what these people believe. Now, again, the vast majority of Masons have no understanding of any of this. They just think it's this good old boys club that teaches, you know, morality. And this is the way with almost all of these groups, whether it's the Mormons or the Masons or the witches or the Vatican, they all had this vast number of reasonably good people, in some cases very good people, under them that are sort of feeding them all of this energy. Because, let me back up. When I was into Satanism, we understood and were taught that Satan draws energy from being worshipped. And when these guys, they don't understand it. Every time a Mason kneels at the altar and swears an oath, the devil gets energy from that. And again, most Masons, if they heard this, they would be scandalized. They'd say, this guy's a nut. But the funny thing is, and like you say, you've talked with people who, to a greater degree or a lesser degree, and believe me, we've talked to dozens of people over the years in ministry who came to us who were, you know, like sodomized as children, who were literally taken to the Masonic Lodge after hours, laid on that very same altar that the Holy King James Bible laid on, and they were gang raped by a bunch of old men that were all high-level Masons until they were practically dead.
Yeah, that's pretty much the story that I heard without, you know, details, because it was an eyewitness account. It was a secondhand witness, but it's similar to what I heard before. Okay. A lot of said about Freemasonry, and you kind of said how, you know, Freemasonry is worshiping Lucifer. And I think that's made very clear in the books that you talked about. If people want to check the references, they can check your book or they can go directly to the references if they doubt anything, because it's in there. I want to go back to something that you said earlier, because we kind of did a tangent on Freemasonry because I thought it was very important. But you talked about selling your soul. Let's get back to that, because I definitely don't want to ignore that. Can you explain the circumstances around that?
Well, again, there was this group in Chicago, and they were entwined with this Memphis Mitzrayim rite, and they were also with this. It was like two things together: the Brotherhood, which I mentioned earlier, and then this Memphis Mitzrayim thing. And I interacted with these people, and at a certain point, they said, "Well, if you want to go any further and become a satanic priest, you need to, you know, sell your soul to the devil." And so they took me to this park in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, which is like a suburb of Chicago. I don't know if it's still there or not, but it was a very weird park. It was broad daylight. And they said, "Don't worry about it. You know, the cops are all devil worshipers." And in the center of the park, there was this like area where they had these weird Egyptian statues. There literally was an altar with horns, you know, kind of like the pictures you see of the altar in the temple of Solomon, you know, that kind of thing. And they brought out this black book, and there are all these names in it, and this one supposed high-level Satanist kind of officiated, and I swore an oath to Satan, my allegiance to him, that I would serve him for 7 years, and he would give me everything I wanted, you know, wine, women, song, power, occult power, whatever. And at the end of those 7 years, he could kill me and take me to hell. By that time, I had been told that the Satanists believe that hell is like one long orgy of drugs, sex, and rock and roll, so to speak, you know. So I didn't think going to hell was a bad thing at that time. So I had to sign my name in blood in this black book. And supposedly, this sounds funny, but I was supposed to go out and find 7 people to sell their souls to the devil under me, so to speak, sort of like multi-level marketing, but for the devil. And I did. I got 7, and I feel so bad about this. I've contacted as many of these people as I can find to try and talk them out of it and, you know, repent and all that. But, you know, and still, I didn't have the things I needed. I had, you know, my life was not good, even though I was supposedly this high-level warlock, satanic priest, blah, blah, blah. I was working at a nothing job. You know, I was a security guard in a warehouse, barely getting by. And then what happened is I'd written a check. Every year I wrote a check to the Church of Satan. I think it was for $10 to renew my subscription. They had a newsletter, probably still do, called The Cloven Hoof. And when I got the check back from the bank, because they used to do that, someone had written on the check, some lady by the handwriting, "I'll be praying for you in Jesus' name." And I just scoffed. And the funny thing is, let me just say, I had not had any contact with Christians. Nobody ever tried to witness to me. Nobody, you know, had ever come to our door and tried to, you know, give us tracts or talk about Jesus. Even the Jehovah's Witnesses never came to our door because they were scared of us, you know, because people understood, you know, they'd see us out in the backyard in the moonlight in black robes dancing around, you know. So anyway, I got this check and I just scoffed at it. And literally within 24 hours, it was like I was hit with a freight train. I lost all my occult power and believe the magical power is real. I lost my job. I got as sick as a dog. And I thought, what the heck? You know, so we had an altar up in the attic. The whole attic, we painted it black. And we had a magic circle on the floor. I had a big statue of Pan, you know, the horned god, all kinds of creepy stuff. And I went up there and I knelt and I prayed to Lucifer. And I said, what's going on? I've done everything you've told me, and my life has just increasingly gone to hell, literally. And the funny thing is, even when I was praying to Lucifer, Jesus answered my prayer. Because the next day, we got a call from these two teenage Satanist girls from Chicago. They wanted to come up and meet me because they heard about I was this great satanic priest. And so they came up on the train. They said, we had a gift for you. And I thought, well, I could use a gift right now because I just lost my job. I don't have hardly any money, you know. And they show up at the door and they sit adoringly at my feet. And they give me these two comic books from Chick Publications. I assume you're familiar with Chick Publications.
I'm not. I think I'm too young for that.
It's a Christian publishing house. And he made these, I don't know how many there are now, but at the time there were like 15 or so full color comic books. But they were about Christian themes. And they were intended to be soul winning tools. And in the back of them, there was, you know, a thing about, okay, how to get born again. And the two that these kids gave me, I say kids because they were probably in their late teens, one was called Spellbound and one was called Angel of Light. And you can look these up. They're probably available online. And they are about the dangers of the occult and about how Lucifer is really the god behind all false religions. And I just looked at them and, you know, whatever, you know, and threw them in the door in the closet and forgot about them. Well, anyway, the next day, there's a knock on the door and we open it up and it's Mormon missionaries. Never had one come before. And they always are in, you know, two of them. Two young men. And I remembered what this guy said, this Grandmaster Druid back in, you know, 1973. We're now in 1980, and we joined the Mormon church because we thought that was where we were supposed to be. This was a sign from Lucifer. So I joined the Mormon church. I tried to be a good Mormon. I stopped doing dope. I stopped having orgies. I was just monogamous. And the only thing we did, because we had been led to believe by this Druid guy that the Mormons were white witches. And so we still did white witchcraft, but we didn't do Satanism anymore. We got all of that out of our lives. Went to the temple in the Mormon church, did all their secret rituals, which are very Masonic.
Well, let's actually stop there because this is actually important. What kind of role did you have in the Mormon church? Because we just talked about missionaries coming to your house and you said you joined. Can you explain a little bit, you know, the progression and what kind of role you eventually got there?
Yeah, well, okay, you get baptized, and then after a year, if you, you know, mind your P's and Q's and pay your tithing and all of that, you're made an elder. And that's what I was. I was an elder. And then later, I was made an elder's quorum president. So that's like an administrative role right under the bishop. Now, understand, in a Mormon church, I don't know if it's still this way, but back then, this is in the 80s, a bishop, like most people think of a bishop as some really high-level guy, you know, in the Mormon church, the bishop is the head of a local congregation. They call it a ward, W-A-R-D. And an elder's quorum president is kind of like right under the bishop and takes care of administrative stuff. And I had gotten a temple recommend, which is like a card that allows you to go to the temple because you're not allowed to go to the temple unless you're worthy. And at that time, we went to Salt Lake City because that's like the Cadillac of Mormon temples, the Salt Lake Temple. And we went through the rituals, and that, I'll tell you, that's a whole story in itself. Do you want to get into that?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, well, so we go. Now, mind you, we had information from this Grandmaster Druid. He said, give these words to the guy when you go into the Mormon temple. And they had a system, which was probably kind of ahead of its time. This was, let's see, 1981, where you had this card and it had a code on it. Like nowadays, everybody's familiar with this, some kind of magnetic coding. They'd put it into the machine and that would indicate that you're legit. And then we were told to say these words. And when we put these words into the computer after our card, the whole system it crashed, the entire computer system. And so they didn't know what to do about that. So they got rid of the people that they could. They took us through the ritual, which involves it's hours long. It's kind of like the Masonic ritual on steroids. I mean, you go downstairs, you get all basically naked. They wash your body, and it's done man to man, woman to woman. But they wash your body, they anoint your body with oil. You're given this magical temple garment, which you may or may not have heard of. And what's interesting is, just to back one step up, a lot of people don't know, Joseph Smith was the founder of the Mormon Church. In 1844, he was made a Master Mason in Nauvoo, Illinois. And after he was made a Master Mason, he kind of stole most of the Masonic ritual and created this temple ceremony. The whole thing is just bizarre, and I go into great depth. I have a video called Mormonism's Temple of Doom, a DVD that you can get that goes into all this in detail. But anyway, this is where it gets kind of odd, because after this is all over, we were invited to go meet with the president of the Salt Lake Temple, which is kind of a big deal. And he said, "What can I do for you?" And I said, "Well, we've been told," we didn't say by a druid, "but we've been told that we need to talk to an apostle." Now understand that in the Mormon Church, there's this hierarchy. There's the prophet, who's called the president, and then there's the first presidency, which is two advisors and the prophet. Under them are 12 apostles. So he said, "Well, I'll see what I can do." So he arranged for us to go to the church office building and meet with one of the 12 apostles. At that time, it was Elder James Faust. Believe it or not, that was his name, Faust, which is kind of weird. Faust is a very prominent name in the history of the occult. So we went there, up into the church office building, and to make a long story short, he said, "Well, what do you want to talk to us about?" I said, "Well, we had these dreams." And this is true. And again, back then, nobody knew what was going on in the Mormon temples. The stuff had not been made public in any way. A couple of years after this, Chuck and Dolly Sackett put out a book called "What's Going On in There." They were former temple workers, and they revealed the whole thing. But at this time, there was no anybody. And I said, "We saw this ritual where there was this white altar with a satin covering, just like what's in the celestial room of the Mormon temple. And on it was this naked young girl, and everybody was around chanting, 'Hail Lucifer.'" And he said, this apostle guy, he said, "Well, I can tell you are very extraordinary people, and I bear you my solemn testimony." This is a big deal. If you ever talk to a Mormon, if they start saying, "I bear you my solemn testimony," this is like a big deal for them, that what you have said is true. "And if you can come to Salt Lake and live here, we will find a place for you in the worship of the temple."
So I'm actually curious about one thing. So you talked about the druid telling you that Luciferian secrets were found in Freemasonry and in the Mormon Church, right? And you had been a Freemason at that point. You also went to the temple in Salt Lake. Can you talk about the similarities, if there are some, and what are they between Freemasonry and Mormonism?
Well, first of all, if you go to Temple Square, you'll see Masonic handshakes. You'll see the all-seeing eye. You'll see the sun, the moon, the stars. There's no crosses on the Mormon temple. There's nothing Christian on the outside of the Mormon temple. When you get inside the temple, most of the similarities are the fact you go through three levels. And in each level, you're made to, you're taught hand signs and handshakes and things that are all very similar to Masonic stuff. And you are made to swear an oath. And you, when in the first level, which I think is, I mean, it's been ages since I've gone through all of this, you put your hand to your throat and go like this, the same as you do in the entered apprentice degree of the Masonic Lodge. In a third level, you are taught another set of secret handshakes, and then you're instructed, and this is where it gets really Masonic. You're instructed to go up, and they have this veil, which they say is like the veil in Solomon's temple. So you've got Masonic markings. You have a square and a compass on the your chest. You have another marking on your navel and another Masonic marking on your knee. Okay. These same markings are on the veil, but they're stitched so they're holes. And there's a guy on the other side of the veil that you can't see who represents Heavenly Father. He represents God. And you go up to this guy and you're instructed, you put your hand through the veil, and this is called the five points of fellowship. And this is right out of Masonry and right out of witchcraft. Gardnerian, Alexandrian witchcraft and Masonry and Mormonism all have these five points. And the five points of fellowship are foot to foot, knee to knee, hand to back, breast to breast, and mouth to ear. I think I got that right. And anyhow, so you're embracing this unknown guy through this veil, and he whispers to you the secret name of the celestial kingdom. And you ready for this?
I don't know. I think
it's health in the navel, marrow in the bones, strength in the loins and in the sinews, power in the priesthood. Be upon me and my posterity for all generations of time and all eternity. Now, that might sound reasonably benign, except for the fact that it's almost word for word out of the satanic grimoire. It's a satanic incantation. The only difference is that obscene words are used. And then, when you're done with that, this guy draws you through the veil into what is called the celestial room, the celestial kingdom. And basically, it's like this beautifully appointed, everything is in white or light beige, you know, with sofas. It's like being in a really fancy hotel lobby. And people are invited to just sit and absorb the wonderfulness of it. And they believe, literally, that God the Father, who they believe to be a man in a body, and they believe that he invisibly walks around this celestial room. And I don't know if you know this or not, but they believe he has hundreds of goddess wives. And that he is constantly impregnating these wives who give birth to spirit children who come down. And they believe that every child that is born on earth is first fathered in heaven with Heavenly Father and one of his goddess wives.
Yeah, I've heard about that. And I think a lot of Mormons, if they hear you talking, they'll say that's not true. But if you actually go back to the history of what Joseph Smith taught, like you'll see. And if you talk to some of the elders probably in the Mormon church that know about this stuff, they'll tell you about it. But what I find in what you said is essentially that, you know, the details of Mormonism and Freemasonry, like the details are different, but the structure is very, very similar. And you can see where it kind of Joseph Smith took it from, especially since he was a Freemason. So that's super interesting. I want to go back to your story, though. Because you joined the Mormon church to try to help your life. Your life was, you were really struggling at the time, and you're trying to, you know, become a better person, have a better life and all of that. What did your life look like inside of the Mormon church?
Well, it was better. But of course, part of that was because I was no longer actively worshiping the devil. I mean, I thought I was worshiping the true God, but I wasn't. And I eschewed all of my vices. I mean, I was no longer doing cocaine or smoking dope, or I never was one for drinking alcohol. So, I mean, it was better. But as I rose in the ranks, and this is kind of an, I'm glad you asked this question, as I became an Elders Quorum president, and again, I don't know how things are now, but back in this, and this was in the early 80s, the Elders Quorum president was supposed to see that all of these guys under him, these elders, would go out and visit every home in the ward, in the local congregation, to see how they were doing and to bring them a message from the prophet, quote unquote. And I'll tell you one thing, the Mormons get right. Like I tell people, even a broken clock is right twice a day. And they are very good at taking care of their people. If you saw a neighbor who was in trouble in some way, like they needed their sidewalk shovel or whatever, you would go do that. And the idea was you were going to go and love bomb this neighbor and make them want to join the Mormon church. And that's pretty good. You know, I mean, I don't fault that. But, you know, you got to realize, for me, just let me just put this in perspective. At this time, I had a job working in a retail store, 40 hours a week. In addition to that, I literally had to spend another 40 hours a week working for the Mormon church with no pay, because none of the people, except at the very highest levels of the Mormon church, get any salary. So again, that's an admirable thing, but I was just working myself to death. And I oftentimes would have to go and do the home teaching because I couldn't find somebody else to do it. And I would visit these people and I would talk to these people. I'll tell you this one story. There was this one guy, I won't say his name, but he was this older fellow. He was sweet as can be, married, had a family, but he was stuck at being a deacon. A deacon is a 12-year-old boy. If you turn to the age of 12 years old, the bishop lays hands on you and makes you a deacon. So this guy was stuck at being a deacon because he wasn't worthy. Why wasn't he worthy? He couldn't stop smoking. And as you may know, there's the big no-nos in the Mormon churches. You can't smoke. Of course, you can't take any kind of illegal drugs, and you can't drink coffee. So this guy was trying, you know, I don't know if you've ever been a smoker, but it's a hard thing to get off your back. And I would give this guy priesthood blessings. I would pray with him. I would fast with him. I'd do all this. And he was stuck. He was going to end up being like the Mormon church's only 90-year-old deacon because of the merciless quality of Mormonism and the fact that it didn't really have any power to transform his life. And there were numerous stories like that. And it began to put a crack in my belief in Mormonism, because I thought, okay, if this is the true church, which is what they teach, then why, if I'm holding the priesthood, you know, I was a holy Melchizedek priesthood elder, and if I laid hands on a guy to be set free from nicotine, why didn't that work? Especially when I was doing it like every week.
Especially because you had been in the occult before and you had some of the power of the occult. And so it's like you understood that there was power somewhere and that Lucifer could give you power, and that you thought you were in the true church and you found none of this power. So I understand. But what did you do? Because you said it started to question your whole worldview. Like, how did that develop over time?
Well, yeah. Okay, leaving on that, I ended up having to move out of Milwaukee. Because at that time, my wife wanted to go to nursing school, and there was a nursing school in Dubuque that was good. And so I was without a job. And I had some time on my hands, and I was trying to find work. And I was plugged into the local Mormon church in Dubuque, the ward there. But of course, I was no longer an Elders Quorum president. And I saw this thing in the local Penny Advertiser, you know, that said, oh, there's going to be a prophecy seminar at this park. And, oh, well, that's good. I thought I can go to this prophecy seminar, because it didn't say what church it was, and I can steal some sheep. because I belong to a church that's being run by a true prophet, you know, whoop-de-doo. And so I went to this thing, and I had never been to a Protestant service. And there was this evangelist up there, and they were talking about the book of Revelation. And this guy was presenting the gospel in the context of explaining their version of what the book of Revelation means. So anyway, he was talking about how you're saved by grace through faith, you know, the basic Christian gospel. And I kind of raised my hand, being, you know, this wiseacre, because they didn't know I was a Mormon. And you see, Mormons teach that basically there's only two choices for the true church. Either the Catholics, who claim, you know, to have this apostolic succession all the way back to Peter up to the present day, or else Joseph Smith, who was supposedly given this mandate in the year 1830 by the angel Moroni and by John the Baptist and whatever. And because they said that all the Protestant churches were split off of the Catholic Church, and so therefore they had no authority. And so either you got to be a Catholic or you got to be a Mormon. And so I raised this point with this guy, and he says to me, well, where do you get the idea that you need to be baptized in order to be saved? It says in Acts 16:31, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and thou shalt be saved, and thy house. And that was the Bible verse that hit me. You know, because I'd already read the whole King James Bible, because the Mormons use the King James Bible. I read the Bible through 5 times as a Mormon. But I'd never seen that verse, like, you know, how Bible verses leap out at you. And this verse went through my magic Mormon underwear like a bullet through a sheet of wet tissue paper. And I went home, and I was trembling, and I prayed, and I fasted. Because that's what Mormons are supposed to do. If you run into a spiritual dilemma, it says right in Doctrine and Covenants, which is one of the Mormon scriptures of the four. They have 4 scriptures. They have the Bible, the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price. And I prayed and I fasted. And supposedly, if you do that, if what you're thinking of is true, you get a burning in your bosom. And if it's not true, the Holy Spirit will send you a stupor of mind and you will forget what you're even talking about. So I didn't get either one. And so I did bring to mind the comic books that I had gotten 5 years earlier or more by this time. And I went and dug them out because I remember in the back of it was How to Be a Christian. And so I got down at the foot of my bed. I knelt. I took off my magic Mormon underwear because I didn't want any static on the line when I talked to God. And I prayed the prayers in the back of that comic book, and I got born again. And that was the beginning of my journey as a true Christian. So I got saved partly through the Assemblies of God, but then I was going to study to be a minister. And there were stipulations that if you were either you or your wife were divorced, and my wife was a divorcee, you can't be a minister. At that time, that was the rule in the Assembly. So I went over to the Foursquare Church, which is a symbol. I don't know if you're familiar with charismatic churches, but it's another charismatic church. And there, the pastor and his wife did deliverance on me. I got set free from a whole legion of demons, I'm sure.
Especially with the things you were involved in, a lot of which we didn't touch on because they're quite graphic, and you know, for the sake of time, we can't talk about everything that you've gone through because you have so much. There's something that you talked about. Obviously, we talked about you selling your soul. Now you accepted Jesus. I remember you talking about how the covenant or the deal that you made with the devil was for 7 years. So what happened with that?
Well, thankfully, okay, that was made in 1979. And I got saved in 1984. And when I got saved, that wiped out that stupid covenant. It took the power of the devil off of me because I became a child of God. And of course, I renounced that covenant. Part of, you know, I mean, I know there's different ways that people do deliverance. And I don't know how familiar you are with deliverance, but, you know, one of the things that we encourage people to do, and I was encouraged to do, was like I went through and I renounced all of my Masonic oaths. I renounced all of the oaths and covenants I took in the Mormon church. I renounced the baptismal vows of the Catholic Church, and I renounced that oath that I took to the devil in that park in Glen Ellen and nailed it all to the cross.
So it was, you became a Christian before the 7 years had actually passed. And who knows what would have happened if that didn't, I guess we're never going to know. But there's something else that I would not be a good interviewer if I didn't ask you, because Freemasonry is kind of a secret thing. You can't talk about it. You already mentioned that you're breaking these rules. How were you able to be so open against Freemasonry as a former Mason? Do you have any repercussions? Did that ever happen to you? Oh. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you could say that. I have had so many attempts on my life. Can't even begin to tell you, but what partially helped me was the fact, and I'll just insert this little tale since you say you like stories. When I moved to Dubuque, I wanted to go and reconnect with the Masonic Lodge in Dubuque. And so I went to the, and this was right after, literally about a week after I got born again. The Masonic Lodge had, they called it a high 12 luncheon, which was on Friday noon. And everybody was welcome. And I went to this luncheon. It was like a free meal. And I got in there, and it's down in the basement of this big lodge thing, downtown Dubuque. And as I was eating, I could feel this darkness. I've been in Masonic lodges hundreds of times. But because now I had the Holy Spirit within me, I could feel something dark and evil and oppressive just pushing down on me. And I, you know, ate the lunch, and I felt like this voice in my head saying, "My son, get out of here." So I even skipped dessert, which for me was a big deal back then. And I went outside, and this was in June, into the bright June sunshine, and I felt like this incredible weight was off me. So I went home, and I was led to go to Ezekiel chapter 8. Let me just read it, because it's amazing how this dovetailed with the Masonic Lodge. Okay, here we are. I'm not going to read, it's kind of long, but he says he's digging through the wall, and he says, you know, and this is in verse 13 of chapter 8. He said to me, this angel or whatever, "Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see greater abominations that they do," meaning the elders of Israel. "Then he brought me to the gate of the Lord's house, which is toward the north, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz." Now, Tammuz is a false, slain, and risen god who's part of the Masonic pantheon. "Then said unto him, Hast thou seen this, O son of man? Turn thee yet again, and thou shalt see the greater abominations than these." And he brought, now this is critical, verse 16, "And he brought me to the inner court of the Lord's house, and behold, the door of the temple of the Lord between the porch and the altar were about 25 men with their backs toward the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, and they worshiped the sun toward the east." Now, why is that important? Well, Masonic temples are required to face east. The worshipful master is in the east, and he is a symbol of the sun. And all the devotions of the Masonic Lodge face east. That means, theoretically, they have their back to the Ark of the Covenant. They have their back to the truth. And there's a thing in Masonic ritual. Whenever they have a ritual you go through whenever they open the lodge, you know, every week they open the lodge. And they go around, and when they come to the worshipful master, it says, "As the sun rises in the east to rule and govern the day, so also rises the worshipful master in the East to rule and govern the lodge. And then the master stands up and he knocks up the lodge, which means he raps the gavel three times. And the symbolism was so vivid when I saw that scripture, because I had been immersed in Masonry for 9 years. I knew it backwards and forwards, and I realized this was an indictment of the Masonic Lodge. And within a week, I sent a letter to the Masonic Lodge and asked to have my name taken off the worlds.
There's so much. And for the sake of time, I know you have to go, so we'll have to wrap it up. It's unfortunate because there's so many things that we could talk about, but you wrote books. You have a bunch of stuff. If people want more detail, they can go there. They can find you. I'll put all the links on the website. If you go in the description of this episode, you'll be able to find all of that. But to end, Bill, I want to ask you and give you this opportunity to give a message. And usually I only ask people one, but for you, I wanted to make it a little bit different because you've been in so many different things. You were a Satanist, a Freemason, and a Mormon. So if you had a message to give to each one of these people that are listening today, what would it be?
Well, I mean, let me start with witches / Satanist. I mean, those people are worshiping power. They think they are trying to become one with nature, but the power they are trying to tap is the power of the devil. And I know a lot of these people, even some Satanists will say, we don't believe in the devil except as an archetype, as a symbol. But they're whistling in the dark. They're making a grave mistake that can cost them their souls. Because, you know, it doesn't matter what you think you believe. The truth with a capital T is out there, and Yeshua is the way, the truth, and the life. And if you reject him, as most witches and Satanists do, then your fate is not good. It's not that God is this big meanie in the sky who's going to send you to hell. It's your decision to ignore Christ or to mock Christ, whatever you want to call it. That is the decision that's going to cost you an eternity in a very dark place. And you don't want to do that. And essentially that same, I would share that same message. I mean, Masons, again, a lot of Masons are Christians. But the problem is, you know, like Elijah said to the prophets of Baal in 1 Kings 18, how long halt ye between two opinions? If Baal is God, serve him. But if the Lord is God, serve him. The Mason, he might be the nicest person you might imagine, but he's knelt at the altar of Baal. He may have one knee on the altar of Christ and one knee on the altar of Baal, and these two things are going to drift apart. And in my experience, I've been ministering to Freemasons since 1988, and it's very hard for a Christian Mason to keep his testimony strong. It's very hard because the Masonic Lodge will just suck all the spiritual fire off of you. So you need to get out of it because the devil is after you. And even though it might seem good at the time, you know, there's a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof is death. And I'd say the same, almost the same thing to the Mormons. Except the problem is with the Mormons, you're totally worshiping a false God. You're totally worshiping a false Jesus. You're following a plan of salvation, which is absolutely false. And you're in a very dark, I mean, Mormonism is honestly darker than Masonry, in my humble opinion. So if you're in the Mormon church, you probably don't feel that evil. But the men at the top of the Mormon church are devil worshipers. And that spiritual power is percolating downward into you and into your family because of the way headship and authority works in the world. So again, you need to get out of the Mormon church. You need to find a good Christian church that really believes in the Bible. And, you know, again, renounce it. Renounce your baptism. And if you've been to the temple, renounce your temple vows. and then go and get baptized by a Christian pastor, you know, and you'll be hopefully on your way. But yeah, all three of those paths ultimately will end in the same place, even though the one seemed much darker than the other two. But the devil disguises himself as an angel of light, Paul tells us, so that he can deceive us. So that's what I would say. Trust in Yeshua, Jesus Christ. Don't trust in Joseph Smith. Don't trust in the false Christ of Masonry, who is called Hiram Beef. And certainly don't trust in Satan.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Almost False Podcast. Unfortunately, Bill is a very busy man, and I only had a couple hours with him, which is woefully insufficient to talk about everything that he's experienced. I'm trying to get him on the show again. If that happens, I'll leave a link in the description. But whether it happens or not, I highly encourage you to go check out his content. If you want more in-depth knowledge about what he said, then his books are the best place to go. You can find them by clicking the guest info link in the description of this episode. Thank you again for listening. I hope you learned something. Have a good one, and stay blessed.